I'm speaking today with Ben Hall, who is running for mayor of Houston. Mr. Hall, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
First question I'd like to ask, very simply, why are you running for this office?
I think that the city needs leadership with vision as opposed to a person who simply is a manager at best in the mayor's office. I have gone back and considered Ms. Parker's 16 years in elected office, and I cannot discern policies that I think that she has advanced that will sustain this city going into the future. And as I've surveyed a number of individuals that I consider to be attentive to these issues of politics, they likewise have had some challenge in setting forth policies that she has advanced as an elected official to sustain the city going forward. And as such, I think that where we are in history and the opportunities that are being afforded to this city, we must have a leader who can prepare the city for the future and not just the present. Struggling with present problems is obviously a necessary function of governance, but it cannot be the only. And I think that Ms. Parker's view of the mayor's office is on the shallow end of that inquiry.
Now, you have served the city before as city attorney under Mayor Bob Lanier.
I have.
Tell me about your experience as that and what it taught you about city government and how you might apply that someday towards being mayor.
In fact, that was a refreshing exposure to what a right-thinking and forward-thinking mayor can do for a city. I think that Bob Lanier is one of the best examples of leadership. Now, you may not agree with his policies, but in terms of taking hold of an idea and wrestling it to a successful conclusion, I've not seen many that were better at that craft. And so when I saw the simple inquiries of citizens become issues of profound policy shift once they came out of the mouth of the mayor, I was so impressed by how the mere adoption of an idea by the mayor could move and affect the lives of so many people. I can tell you that I actually said to Bob Lanier as I was about to leave that he had actually impregnated me with the wonders of what it would be to be a leader of a great city. And it was there that birth was given to the idea that I might one day run for mayor.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, since you've referenced vision, not just here, but in your campaign, what is your vision for Houston? What are your priorities? What is your vision for Houston?
Let's talk about three key priorities that have been neglected. One is 65% of the city right now is unsustainable. That's not my number. The Kinder Institute determined that in 2010, and unsustainable meaning that it costs the city more money to provide basic city services, not extravagant city services, basic city services. It costs us more money to provide those services to 65% of the city than we actually get back in tax revenue from that entire area. Well, we can't continue this city with that kind of unsustainable population. We must immediately address turning those areas into sustainable areas, which means even if we were to bring them to just an equilibrium between cost and tax revenue, that would be better for the city than to have it in the negative that we presently have. This mayor has done nothing to address that inquiry, nothing. And I think that's poisonous to our future, and we must address it. Number two, we can no longer tolerate growth and not bring our infrastructure to a first-class status. When we have roadways the way that we presently have them, it's going to discourage the further development, economic growth inside the city. We must immediately address the infrastructure demands And then that brings into play something that's fundamentally different between the present incumbent and Ben Hall. We must make it as attractive for businesses to operate inside the city as they presently are finding it to be outside the city. Where over the last 10 years, 93% of the economic growth in this area has occurred outside the city limits, and only 7% has occurred inside the city. We must ask the question, why is it that businesses are choosing to position themselves outside the city? What burdens are we placing on them, or what services are we failing to provide that's incentivizing them to do so? Costco just recently made a conscious decision not to put their store inside the city limits of Houston, and then asked for some tax concessions from the city, which this administrator gave. Well, I would ask the question aggressively, what do I need to do to incentivize your coming into the city as opposed to being outside? Unless we address those three, and I think that we must diminish the burdens that we're placing on businesses, we must lower the costs, lower the expenses, lower the taxes, eliminate some of these drainage fees that are being assessed in order to incentivize new growth. There will be a tension in this equation, but it is really the only way forward. We cannot continue to overburden the occupants of the city to the point where they start fleeing and take up residence outside the city.
Well, let's talk about infrastructure, because I think everyone would agree that Houston has infrastructure needs. Now, Rebuild Houston, that was passed by the voters in 2010, was intended to come up with a funding source to, you know, improve drainage, rebuild roads. You know, what do you have in mind as a way of identifying where the need is greatest and and paying for it?
Well, I appreciate the tail end of your question, wanting to direct it on where the need may be, but I challenge the actual need of the drainage fee in the first instance. When I had my radio show here in Houston, actually campaigned against the drainage fee. And the reason I did it, because I felt then, as I now know it to be, it was being misrepresented to the voters. Ms. Parker actually affirmatively represented to the voters that would be on average $5 per residential property. Well, since this election cycle, I've asked for the objective proof to support that promise to the voters. There is none. She literally pulled that out of the air and put that number out in front of the voters. I knew it could not be a correct proposition because of the way, the modality that they were suggesting for pricing it. So we've now proven that it was a falsely represented fee to save $5 on average. But then more importantly, the moment the money started coming in and it passed, Ms. Parker did precisely what she said she wouldn't do. And that was, she had previously represented to the voters that the drainage fee would be used for shovel-ready projects on drainage and street projects. Instead, the moment the money came in, she paid salaries with it in public works. That's wrong. And then she didn't stop that practice until this year, when we called her out in February and said, ma'am, you misrepresented to the voters that you were going to use the drainage fee for shovel-ready projects, road and drainage issues, and you're paying it for salaries. Well, this year, you'll notice she moved it now out of public works salaries. Well, Charles, all of that is false representation to the voters. And no matter how you play it, it shows, from my standpoint, an integrity issue. You just have to tell the voter, honestly, I need this money, and this is what I'm going to use it for. But you don't manufacture justifications because you want revenue and then use it for something wholly different from what you represent to the voters. But let's get beyond that, which are fundamental threshold issues of integrity, and get to the proposition where you are. It's an unworkable system unless we do some adjustments. I applaud the concept of pay as you go. I think that's a wonderful concept, but that's not what's happening. What we have is pay salaries and let the roads remain dilapidated. That's what she's been doing. And then the other evening in the debate, her solution was, well, in 20 years from now, you're going to have better roads. Well, that's an unacceptable answer. We're going to have to raise revenue, an additional revenue stream, the way that I've suggested. And that is by reducing the burdens on new businesses and new growth in the city in order to generate more revenue coming into the city so that you can attend to these road problems now. You can't expect the taxpayer today to say, oh, by the way, you're not going to have a good road for 20 years in your neighborhood. That's an unacceptable solution. Now, she, when I challenged her on this premise, she has come out now with, well, I'm going to do a worst roads analysis. Well, that wasn't what it was when we started in February in this election year. I was complaining because it was complaint driven. I said, this is a faulty way of driving repairs. It was complaint driven, meaning whoever was complaining and the squeaky wheel was actually getting the attention. That was the policy until we pointed it out and criticized it in this election cycle. Now she wants to adopt worst roads analysis. Quite honestly, that should have been the analysis long ago. But it wasn't. And it's telling that the first time we start getting real leadership ideas is only after she starts copying them from her opponent who's running against her. Now, this may be unpleasant for others to hear, but it happens to be the truth. If you tell me year one of her mayor's race, did she come up with these ideas? No. Year two in the mayor's office, did she come up with these ideas? No. Year three, did she come up with these ideas? No. Before Ben Hall announced that he was going to run for mayor in February, did she come up with the ideas? No. When did she come up with them? Only after Ben Hall started criticizing that they were on the wrong path. That shows a lack of leadership.
Okay, so would you advocate another election to repeal the charter amendment that created the drainage fee? And if so, how would you replace it?
It's not necessary to replace. I think that we can generate the revenues that are necessary to address the road repair without doing it by manufacturing this drainage fee. It's a false need that was created by someone who didn't have forward thinking on how to generate new revenue. And I know that some of this is hard-hitting, and it is, because there are fundamental choice differences in this race. But to answer your question, I would not be opposed to a ratification election at an appropriate time without extra cost. I would not want to generate the burden of cost on the city just for a ratification a charter amendment. I would, however, first probably poll it before I call for a ratification charter amendment on this issue.
Okay. What is your view of the city's financial picture overall? I mean, as you know, 4 years ago, there was a big budget deficit due in large part to downturn in the economy, reduced revenue. The economy is largely turned around in Houston. Budget is in better shape. What is your view of the city's financial picture as things stand today?
I think that the budget situation is as bad and abysmal as it was 4 years ago, if not worse. The revenue potential is much better, but those are fundamentally different inquiries. Now, I'm assuming, because you use the word budget, that you're talking about revenue and cost at the same moment. Now, if you're talking about revenue yield, that's a totally different issue. I don't classify that as budget. So let me address the two different issues there. Ms. Parker, when she was the comptroller, failed to alert that the pension underfunding caused the budget not to be balanced. Her sole role as comptroller was to say, we don't have enough money to pay our obligations, and therefore not to certify funds. That was one of the fundamental contests I had with the comptroller when I was the city attorney, that the comptroller is supposed to sit there and say, these are the collective obligations of the city, these are the amortized payments for them, and do we have enough money in this budget to pay those amortized costs? Well, Ms. Parker knew as the comptroller that the budgets the pension funds were underfunded. And she knew that they were underfunded by several millions of dollars. And notwithstanding that knowledge, for whatever political expediency or whatever, she failed to do her job, which was to say, I can't certify funds because they're not available. Instead, she continued to certify budgets and certify funds by ignoring a looming matured obligation. So when she says she inherited a fiscally tight picture when she became mayor, it's because of her own making, in part, because she was actually in the driver's seat to say, we need to streamline the budget or reduce costs in some way. She didn't do it. So when she steps into the mayor's chair, and you have a downturn, as you characterize it, in revenue yield because of the market particularities, she still had the obligation then as mayor to say, I must only present a mature, a balanced budget. She still did not. Instead, she laid off 776 people, but that did not cure the deficit. I hear this often, 707, add up all of their salaries in 1 year. It would not have cured the deficit in the budget. But yet we yield to her this sense of accomplishment because of that displacement. It didn't occur. What happened is she rolled matured obligations forward, which still are out there unpaid. So that next year we have a projected shortfall, independent of the pension underfunding, of $81 million. $81 million is projected to be the unfunded budget, even if we just stick with her numbers, that are unpaid. We also have the $3 billion underfunded pension. So I'm not going to get the pom-poms out and say that Ms. Parker has wonderfully addressed these issues. She hasn't. And that's why I'm coming forward to say we must do a better job. And let me tell you how to do it. You're not going to do it by raising fees and expenses and ticketing people for parking at night in front of the houses. The only way is to structurally change the way that we generate revenue inside the city. Right now we're generating 100% of our revenue needs from 35%. We've got to change that equation by having the 65% unsustainable area become sustainable. And the only way to do that is going to make it as attractive, if not more attractive, for new industry to come inside and put their footprint in the city as opposed to outside. That's the only structural change that's going to address the chronic and persistent fiscal needs that we have at the city.
Let's talk specifically about the pension issues, mm-hmm. since, again, I think everyone agrees that there are issues there that need to be addressed, some of which need to be addressed by the legislature. I would like to know what specifically you, if you were tomorrow, or January 3rd, let's say, mm-hmm. given complete control over the three pension funds, police, fire, municipal employees,
true.
What specifically would you do to address the pension issues?
I would discontinue the hostile tone out of the mayor's office toward pensionees and pension boards. That hostility does not create any environment for compromise. It's precisely the kind of ridiculousness that we see in Washington, D.C., where people stake out their positions and then they've not left any room for compromise. So that's number one, and that's very important, that we diminish and remove this kind of tone of hostility between the mayor's office and these pension boards and pension groups. That's number one. Number two, I would invite the pension assumptions to be revisited. Right now, if we have an aggregate 30-year actuarial life that we are funding, would it be a possibility to stratify the actuarial yield from 30 years fixed to 3 decades? And if we then had 3 decades, then it seems to me the highest risk is going to be in the first decade of actuarial payments or the second decade of actuarial payments, but the third decade of actuarial payments is going to be more spotty. and therefore it might be available to be put out into the private sector for a pricing reduction, which I think is going to be profoundly available if someone would just think to do that. In other words, we are going to guarantee the promises that we have made to our employees historically, but we have to stop that going forward. But just for right now, the fixed and matured promises we've made, if we were to just, as opposed to deal with it as an aggregate actuarial yield, as opposed to a three-decade risk pool analysis, we could, I believe, it would inure to the benefit of the city that present contributions would appreciably fall while at the same time guaranteeing performance, because we're putting out, say, the third decade to the private sector market. I would aggressively look at that option. Number three, this issue of locality of the dispute where the mayor is saying, I want local control. Well, fine. Say you have local control. What's still the solution? As a lawyer, we call that diversionary thinking, where the opponent, because they can't deal with the actual issue, want to redefine it into some issue that they think that they can deal with. Well, here, I say to Ms. Parker, it doesn't matter whether it's in Austin or in Houston. What's the solution once it gets wherever you desire it to be? That's the issue that she still has no answer to, and I do. I've already even reached out to some of the private sector enterprises to say, would you be interested in assuming this third tier, this third generation, third decade risk? Absolutely. Absolutely. We're interested in it because we can do more with money than you can. At least I'm open to those possibilities. And then going forward, yes, we're going to have the agreement with the employees that we're not going to be able to give them as aggressive a retirement plan as has been historically given to prior employees, and I would be open to that.
Are you interested in shifting the retirement plans from the current defined benefit to a defined contribution plan, like a 401k?
You know, At one time I was lured into answering that question incorrectly. And let me tell you this, we don't have a defined benefit plan. I've looked at it. When I heard that language, it seemed that people thought that they knew what they were talking about when they said it. But that's not what we have. We have a growth plan. We have an inflationary kicker in it. We have a redefinition and re-inclusion of new assets and new benefits into it. But I don't see it as a defined benefit. We have an amorphous system of promises. But I think your question yields a more specific answer. Even if I want to play around with the language, your question still deserves an answer. And the question that I think is hidden in what you're asking is, would I be interested in a budgetary limit on the pension payment, however you might describe it, as opposed to what the benefits are to the employee? And I think the answer is, I think in collective bargaining, we could get there. That there is more budgetary certainty to the inquiry from the city standpoint. I think that, yes, we could get there.
I want to come back to this, what you talked about, the 65%, the 35%. Mm-hmm. Do you see this as an issue of, you know, neighborhood development? Do you see this as an issue of this? I want to hear you flesh that out a bit more. What do you want to see done to the 65% of the city that, you know, costs more to in services than what they generate in tax revenue?
Let me show this to you. This is the actual map of Rice University's Kinder Institute. Everything in red that you see on that map is unsustainable. Mm-hmm. Everything you see in green is the only thing that's sustainable. And you'll see it's Clear Lake, it's Kingwood, and it's the west side of town and downtown. That's it. So your question is, what do I want to see done? I would like to incentivize new industry into those red areas. And to do that, by giving advantages or incentives to those businesses to come into those areas that are now draining revenue from the city. And because I've already announced that, I actually have some private insector groups that have already come to me and said, Ben, we love what we hear from you. When you're mayor of the city of Houston, we want to bring this new revenue into the city of Houston. Yes, we will commit to be in the city limits of the city of Houston, creating jobs, revenue, bringing new industry, new enterprises into the city, if you can make it viable for us economically. That's what I want to see done in those red areas.
So when you say make it economically viable, you mean what specifically?
Well, there are a lot of tools in the toolbox for a city. You can have one of your strongest tools is the population itself. We have a customer base that's readily available inside the city limits. Access to that customer base is something to be sold to new businesses coming in. Two would be making sure that we can give tax incentives or tax, tax incentives would be a better way of doing it, tax rebates for improvements that are brought into those areas by new industry that benefits the public. We could consider the issue of consideration of these new industries coming into the city for city contract business. In other words, looking at the possibility of giving some kind of favorable consideration for job opportunities or job creation potential. That's a little more challenging, but it's something that we could probably work out the law on. I see it as a partnership potential where we give improvements in infrastructure if the new investors will stay in on tax revenue or property tax contributions to the city. I see it as an opportunity to reduce some of the infrastructure cost if the private sector will put in new lines and new sewer and new infrastructure, that the city could give them some credit or some offset to that. And then I see the possibility of complementary businesses being brought in around these new enterprises and encouraging the development of those complementary businesses.
Let's talk about crime for a minute, since you've made that an issue in your campaign, an issue that you've highlighted. What is your vision for improving public safety in Houston?
Yeah. I saw the analysis at a different point than assuming that criminals have a right to be in the city. Most people assume, looking at the statistics, that we have to always keep chasing the criminal. And what I want to do is ask the question aggressively, how do we make it unpleasant for the criminal to be here in Houston? And so I start the analysis there, but I don't end it there. I start by saying, what is it that criminals least like? What they least like is being caught. And what can we do to remove their anonymity, which is the cloak under which they always want to operate? They want to be in the dark so they can't be seen. They want to rush in and dash before the police officers get there. They want to club you in your hair when you turn your back to them. Or they want to do some sudden act so they can't be caught. Well, I think that we can remove that anonymity, that cloak of anonymity, and let criminals know we're going to catch you, and there's a technology. I've already indicated I'd like to deploy face recognition technology in certain high crime areas. So the criminals, when they come into the area, their cars are identified, their faces are identified. We're not going to have this old archaic way now of nightly news, people showing some grainy surveillance camera saying, do you recognize this individual? Or anybody who recognizes this person, call Crime Watchers. Well, we're going to get rid of that. We're going to say to the criminals, if you don't want to commit a crime, if you want to commit a crime, don't come in Houston, Texas. And if you do commit a crime, this face recognition technology is going to be so exacting, we're going to identify you and we're going to lock you up. Now, we also have to make it unpleasant for criminals when they're locked up. There's literally a mindset out there, Charles, where people are thinking, if I'm hungry tonight, I'll just go hit this person, take their money. If I get caught, one way or the other, I'm going to get a meal tonight. That mindset is actually on the street here in Houston, Texas. So I want to, and I've already started talking to some judges and said, look, I want an aggressive program where if it's a violent criminal or a nonviolent criminal, I want them to have the option to work for us to pay off the debt that they owe society, as opposed to just sitting behind a cell. We're paying for their food, their lodging, their exercise equipment, their cable TV, even their music, and we are the ones that are the victims of their criminal conduct. So I'm going to be very aggressive against criminals to let them know, one, we're going to catch you, and two, once we catch you, we're going to ask that the law give us the option to let you work for us, not in any unconstitutional way, but at least to reduce your sentence so that you're doing something to give back to society. Those, I think, are effective ways. Now, are we going to have more police officers? Yeah. Are we going to have more technology? Yes. We're going to do all of that. But my point is, as a leader, I want the emphasis to first be criminal. You're unwanted here, and I want you to know we're going to take away your anonymity. That's a very different philosophy than the president company.
The Texas Observer has written a couple of articles recently about the discipline process within the Houston Police Department and the difficulty that there often is in getting police officers that don't follow procedures to be disciplined. Now, you represented Chad Holly, the young man, burglary suspect that was viciously beaten by several HPD officers. Mm-hmm. They were all fired, and a couple of them wound up getting reinstated, which mm-hmm. is kind of an example of what the observers talked about. You know, as mayor, you obviously would have some control over the direction HPD goes in. I'm curious as to what your thoughts are about the HPD disciplinary process and the way citizens raise complaints against officers.
Yeah. This is going to be always a persistent problem because you're joining a perfect service with an imperfect tool. The imperfect tool just being humanity. Human beings are going to err in certain areas. But we're asking for perfect performance of the exercise of force and so on. And so when you have that kind of unequal marriage, you're going to have those instances of abuse. And not only did I represent Chad Holly initially, I dropped him as a client after the second charge of burglary against him, but I also represented the four ladies who were being violently raped by Abraham Joseph, a Houston police officer, who was going out to Fuquay and Alameda, Genoa, and pulling them out of cantinas at night and sodomizing them. So I'm very well acquainted with the allegations and the truthfulness of some instances of police brutality. I think that you address it in multiple ways. One is the tone of the mayor. While I support the police officers and I support the dangerous jobs that they do, make it very clear that we have a zero tolerance policy for any kind of abuse against individuals. I make that known out of the mayor's office, not the police chief. It comes directly from me. Number two, we have open access to the citizenry to a review of the police procedures in specific instances, and therefore I would support a citizens review panel for compliance with city policy, not for prosecuting police officers, but just simply saying, under these allegations, these facts, of this video, did it comply with city policy so that the review committee could make a recommendation? We have something like that right now, but really the effectiveness only comes from leadership out of the mayor's office. If it's a meaningful enterprise, as opposed to a mayor standing up and saying, I don't want to show a video of police officers beating someone, I thought that was a demonstration of poor leadership. That had I had that video, I would immediately have gotten on the cameras and said, listen, I'm the mayor of this city, and I have video in my possession that is beneath the dignity of the Houston police officers. It's beneath the dignity of the city of Houston. And it's beneath the dignity of Houstonians. But notwithstanding that, I'm not going to hide and give sanctuary to any police officer who engages in this kind of conduct. And so this flagrant, unpleasant showing is going to be shown to you. I want you to see it. But I want you to know I'm standing up against it. That would have set such a different tone in the city than to have a mayor say, nobody's going to see this until it's prosecuted. It's just, I think that's a failure of leadership. And as the mayor of the city, I can tell you, I'm going to fight for my police officers who do right, and I'm going to fight against the ones who do wrong.
Okay. In 2001, there was a charter amendment passed by the voters in Houston that forbade it from offering domestic partner benefits. Mm-hmm. Mayor Parker's recently called for a review of, you know, a change in the way, you know, an updated city non-discrimination ordinance, and to allow the city to offer what's now called plus one benefits.
Right.
Do you support that?
I do not.
Okay. You would. Okay. Do you believe that any change should be made to that charter amendment from 2001?
And now that's the question that's important. Because the question you asked was, would I support an ordinance of plus one? And I think that the charter amendment clearly prevents that from happening.
All right, I guess, sorry, I didn't perhaps phrase my question properly. Do you support making a change to that charter amendment that would allow the city to offer that kind of benefit? Yes.
I do not.
You do not?
I do not. No, I am... that's not something that I would support.
Okay.
But if the voters were to pass it, I would enforce it.
Okay. Assuming there's no injunction from the courts, this will be the first election held under Texas' voter ID law.
Mm-hmm.
City of Austin and Dallas County have joined with other plaintiffs and the Justice Department in the lawsuit against the voter ID law. Do you think the city of Houston should join in that litigation?
No, that's an interesting question. The answer is no. I think that there are ample people who can advocate the breadth of the Constitution on that question. I think that Judge Greg Costa's initial injunction, I thought, was a reasonable injunction out of his Galveston court. Then I read the Fifth Circuit panel's split opinion on.
Not to interrupt, but that was a different lawsuit having to do with voter registration laws.
Right. And the reasoning under the same is fairly compelling on the issue of identification, especially when Texas purportedly provides the extension of a free election identification card. Let me say, I think that our duty should be to take away as many burdens as possible to ensure the right to vote. And I do see the election identification law as just one more hurdle to people getting to that constitutional right. So I would favor any process that lessens the burden, even if it meant the exclusion of the identification law.
Do you plan to vote for the referendum to fund rehabilitating the Astrodome?
I do. I'm going to vote for that, and I've already advocated for that. I'm going to vote for Proposition 6 as well. I think it's 6 on the water, the future water needs.
And the other county proposition, the Joint Inmate Processing Facility?
I'm going to vote for that.
Yeah. And when people go to vote on November 5th, why should they vote to make you the next mayor of Houston?
Well, I think they should vote for the future of the city of Houston. What's important in this election is, where is the city headed and who is best to take us there? Not where it is now, nor looking at some historical performance. If you remember, everybody who got on the Titanic was full of confidence. They were told that they were in an unsinkable ship. They were told they were in the world's best built ship. In fact, they had the best captain in the world. Edward John Smith was fantastic. He was a fabulous captain. But we all know that at the end of the day, that confidence, those news reports, Edward Smith's reputation didn't mean anything, because he didn't have the vision to look forward for the icebergs. And so when the voters go to the ballot box this year, they have to ask themselves, who is looking forward and who has advanced plans to deal with the economic icebergs for this city going forward? Ms. Parker has not. Ben Hall at least is coming forward with his eye keenly attuned to the forward gaze. We have a great city, but we're not going to get there to our great future destiny by simply patting ourselves on the back about the present. Ms. Parker needs to come forward and show the voters that the future of the city of Houston is going to be more than about bike trails and more than about an app on a cell phone. There's got to be a concerted policy to deal with chronic needs of the city. And I'm the only candidate that's bringing forth those solutions.
All right. Ben Hall, thank you very much for talking to me today.